Nicole Cox, and I am with the Santa Clara County Public Health Department in the Tobacco Prevention Program, and I was one of the policy staff working on the Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant, and I'm going to talk about our work on smoke-free parks in our county. And I have no relationships to disclose. However, I do have the same CDC disclaimer that these are the opinions of me and not the CDC. And just a quick overview of what I'm going to talk about today. And I'm going to start with talking about our strategy, how we went about implementing smoke-free parks, what the results were of our campaign, and then what were some of the challenges we faced and how we overcame them. So kind of to kick it off, you can see an image here of all the tobacco litter or tobacco waste that you found in our community. So that's an obvious concern that we had. And then, of course, the other obvious goals that we were trying to achieve were to reduce secondhand smoke exposure, also to limit youth exposure to tobacco use in the parks, because we were seeing that oftentimes that's where youth and young people go to smoke and use tobacco products. And actually, when we were doing one of our youth cleanups, there was youth that were participating from a local high school and saw some of their peers in the park using a hookah pipe. So it's something that we were, you know, seeing in our community. And then, of course, reducing tobacco litter or tobacco waste. And really wanting to highlight parks as a symbol of health in our community. So the why now question, we had actually had some community work happening around smoke-free parks prior to the start of our Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant, but we did have really limited success working on smoke-free parks initiatives. So the CPPW funding through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act really helped to jumpstart, and it was a very bold and a huge undertaking for us and our community, and you can see the goals here, of course, are very obvious. And then I wanted to put into context what else we were working on, and we were very ambitious, maybe a little bit too ambitious for a two-year grant, but smoke-free initiatives were really part of our broader strategy, and we used media campaigns as well to promote the dangers of secondhand smoke. And even within our smoke-free initiatives, we worked on smoke-free outdoor areas, and that includes parks, outdoor dining, including bars, service areas, common areas of multifamily housing, complexes and outdoor spaces, and then also smoke-free universities and colleges. And then we did interventions in the tobacco retail environment, promoting tobacco retail licensing, and also looking at reducing density and tobacco sales near schools. And then working to educate the public about the public health benefits of a tobacco price increase. And then youth engagement was another huge part of what we worked on with CPPW, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that as it relates to smoke-free parks. And then looking at expanding our tobacco quit support services in both our CBOs and increasing coverage through our local health plans. And then, of course, our broad goal is working to address health disparities in our community and promote health equity. And then I also wanted to mention that another key component of the grant was the creation of a leadership team that included elected officials, labor, business leaders in our community, Kaiser, school districts, and that was a really key component of our work. So just a little bit of information about Santa Clara County, in case you're not familiar with us. We are just south of San Francisco, about an hour south, and we are the largest populated county in the Bay Area and sixth most in California. So we have nearly 1.8 million residents, so a really large county. And then I thought it was interesting that 20% of our population is actually below the age of 15, and the smoking initiation age in our county is 12 years old, so there really is, you know, a large youth base in our county, and you can see the demographic makeup of our county here, and then our smoking rates are 10% for adults and 8% for youth, which, you know, is pretty good. It's really low, but we do have a large county, so that is, you know, a large number of smokers still. So where were we prior to the start of our CPPW intervention? You can see here, hopefully you can see the colors, that we really only had the city of San Jose as 100% smoke-free parks. They had the only smoke-free parks policy, and then we had three cities that had some form of a city policy, either prohibiting smoking in maybe one park in their jurisdiction or prohibiting smoking in designated areas. So we had a lot of work to do. And so how did we really turn this good fortune of CPPW and into a strategy? And it really started with leadership at the county level. We were extremely lucky to have a very strong champion on our Board of Supervisors who, it was his year of presidency in 2010 and wanted to make tobacco prevention his top priority. And that included passing three, actually, comprehensive ordinances around tobacco retail licensing, smoke-free multi-unit housing, and then amending our current smoking ordinance to include creating smoke-free areas in all of our parks and trails, which our county parks are really large. So it was 28 regional parks that were now smoke-free. And this was really intended to be a strategy. Our county board of supervisor wanted to get out in front and be a leader on this so that other cities would feel more comfortable following suit. And so one of the other things I wanted to mention about our strategy and how we work to engage cities in a very strategic way, because something that we were hearing from many of our cities as we were working on these different tobacco policies over the years through our state funding was that although there was support, our cities really were lacking the resources to make it a priority. So they were hearing from residents that this was an issue, but they really couldn't devote staff time and just didn't have the resources to take this on. So what did we do? We said we're gonna have a very strong collaboration between the city and county. We have this huge funding opportunity. Why don't we make cities partners on this initiative? And then community engagement is something that we've been doing for years, so we wanted to really keep that component and strengthen it where we could. So those were two of our main strategies that we worked on. And so what we're kind of calling our insider strategy, so we call it insider-outsider, was providing the funding support to cities. And so what we did was we provided a $30,000 base award, and that was for cities working on two different tobacco prevention initiatives, including smoke-free parks, and then divided the remaining funding based on population. And this was really to let cities explore and investigate and do research to work on development of policy and then implementation if they were ultimately successful in implementing their policy. And so we have 15 cities in the county, and 10 of the cities chose to focus on smoke-free parks, which was great. And then they also chose other strategies, including tobacco retail licensing, smoke-free outdoor dining. So cities were working on multiple policies at the same time. And then what was also really helpful in educating our elected officials even further was having our CPPW leadership team, where they actually had these built relationships with many of the leaders in the county and the cities, and could further educate them on why it was important to get involved in this large effort. And then because we had this base of cities that were funded, one of our goals was also we wanted to build capacity with the city staff and the elected officials that were working on these policies, because this was a really short grant. I think by the time we got the cities contracted, they maybe had a year to spend the funding and get something going, and we all know policy doesn't always move that fast. So we wanted to create a network where we could provide training to the city staff and really build their capacity to take this on in the future. So we brought in our local experts here in the Bay Area, Change Lab Solutions, the Center for Tobacco Policy and Organizing, and we really connected them with these experts that they could build the relationships with and expand their knowledge on the issue. And then it also allowed for them to be able to connect with each other, because you have 10 cities at the same time working on smoke-free parks initiatives, so they could kind of work through some of the barriers that they were seeing in their community, which was really helpful that, they could do that. So now to kind of talk about how we engage the community, and I want to give a shout out to LA County and the Center for Tobacco Policy and Organizing. Have a fantastic model. It's called the Five Phases or Policy Adoption Model, depending on which one of them you talk to about it, but essentially they're the same five steps. And it's looking at doing a community assessment. What are our goals for our campaign? What do we hope to achieve? What's going on in the community, the political environment, doing all that sort of assessment, and then really developing your strategy from what you find out from your assessment. And then, of course, recruitment is often something people want to to bypass and just go with, you know, who you have at the table, but it's, we found it to be a really important component of engaging the community, to make sure that you're involving people who are actually in that city from that community and are, you know, behind what you're working on. And then we work to implement the campaign, and then what comes hopefully after your policy is adopted is that you want to make sure your policy is being implemented well and that you evaluate how your policy is working. So how we kind of got started with doing that was we really utilized our built-in infrastructure that we had. We had a great tobacco-free coalition, which is part of our state funding requirement. And then we had a youth coalition that's also been in existence for a number of years. And they have been working to with a number of youth organizations in the community to further engage youth. And then we had our CPPW leadership team. So we kind of started with those three groups, and then we prioritized and formed five city-based campaigns because we really wanted the efforts to be localized. And then we worked to further engage youth, residents, stakeholders that were identified during our strategy process. And that was really effective. And then our role as a public health department was really more of the conveners of these coalition. We were providing much of the data, the education, the training, you know, how to go about talking to your elected official, what's the policy process like, all of that sort of information that may not be familiar to people that start to get involved. And then one thing we're really proud of, and I have to give a shout out to California Youth Advocacy Network, Tanya's one of the collaborators in the back, they had the foresight really to think about a new way of engaging young people because we were really struggling to, you know, work with our schools. We wanted to expand our youth coalition further out into the community, but it was really hard to work with schools. Staff are overwhelmed and don't want to take on new projects. So what CYN did was put out a youth mini grant project, and that was a $1,000 mini grant. The youth applied for these grants themselves. They worked with their adult allies. It could be broader than just tobacco focus, which I think was really important because we didn't have a lot of tobacco youth organizations in our community, but we did have a lot of youth groups working on alcohol prevention, safety. So what CYN did was they would allow for a broader project as long as there was some tobacco component built within. So if they were concerned about safety, many of the youth groups did litter cleanups in the parks and really work to clean up the parks and also invite community residents to get involved. And so because the youth can't be here, it's during school and this conference is a little pricey, we have a video showing from the youth perspective of why they got involved and what their projects were about. So I'm going to play this, and it worked.
Friend That Live is run through, it's as a club on campus. What they want to do is they want to do a lot of community service activities, and projects like me really inspire them to do more into the community, especially if it's a grant-driven project.
My role as a member of Community Advocacy Teams of Today is working with peers and youth in different cities and trying to get them to be a part of ACT and aid us in the process of reducing the effects of tobacco. There were several reasons why we got involved in this project, but the most important one was making a positive impact on our community. We wanted to make
be a part of their community and actually make a difference, and it's actually a fun thing to do.
There's a thing, our children are our future, and that's very true. It's the youth that have to make the difference, that they can make the difference. They have a voice. They have to be the ones to announce the change. And from then on, the generations will continue this process of helping the environment and each other.
All right. So there you can see that with just a little amount of money for these youth mini grants, they really had a significant impact. And although they maybe thought that they were just going to be doing a tobacco litter cleanup, they were so engaged with what they found. I mean, over 10,000 cigarette butts, and most of these cleanups were like an hour long, and they were collecting 2,000, cigarette butts, and then presenting those to their decision makers and really seeing the response from the decision makers, I think was really, just really got them even more engaged in policy, which is, as the other presenter said, is often really challenging. Okay, so I have only 5 minutes left. So now getting to the results of all of the strategy, did it work? Did we have success in expanding smoke-free parks in our county? And again, you can see just one city at the start. And then you can see here how much change we actually saw in a really short amount of time. And you can see it was also all across the county. We have a little work to do in our north part up there, but there really was significant change. And then here you can see 9 cities and the county implemented smoke-free parks. And 6 of those were 100% smoke-free, and 1 was actually 100% tobacco-free. And then 1 of the cities was not a CPBW-funded community. It was just something they worked on their own. It may or may not have been the collective movement of the county. And then I also thought it was worth mentioning that many of the cities worked on amending their current smoking ordinance and included in that opportunity expanding it to other areas, so smoke-free outdoor dining, some of the other things I mentioned earlier in the campaign. And I also thought it was worth noting that in 3 of those cities where they did try to tackle other tobacco prevention policies like smoke-free outdoor dining in bars or especially tobacco retail licensing, smoke-free parks was actually the only thing that ended up being successful. And I think a lot of that has to do, it's a lot less controversial compared with to those policies. It doesn't really bring in the business community and opposition that we often face when tackling those initiatives. And then it's really a simple policy compared to some of those other policies. So I think that probably had something to do with it. And then I know I'm running out of time, so I'll quickly talk about some of the challenges that we face and how we overcame them. And I kind of set this up in the beginning that really, cities had expressed to us that they just didn't have the resources and the staff expertise and time to devote to working on tobacco prevention. So I really feel that and they have said this to us, that the funding collaboration really did prioritize the issue for them. And in a few of the cities that had been discussing working on these issues, it made them work a lot quicker. Because of the short timeline. And then they also expressed to us through our key informant interviews, and this is kind of in the preliminary evaluation stage of our project, but they did express that the county getting ahead of these issues and getting out in front and showing strong leadership was influential in helping them move along. And then many of the staff expressed that technical assistance and access to experts in the field, as well as their peers, was really helpful for them. And some of the staff I saw giving staff reports, it could have been, tobacco prevention staff working on the issue for 5 or 10 years. We really saw their knowledge on the issues expand. And then again, I think, the youth mini grant project for engaging youth in policy change was very, very, very successful. We're really excited about that. Tanya's here if anyone's interested in talking to her about how that got started. And then we found that really localized action, things like doing the litter cleanups, it got people really involved in really specific type of activities, which we found was really successful for recruitment, where people don't want to come and have a meeting and talk to you about strategies. They'd rather be out doing things in the community. And then with youth incentives, I think most of us know are really key If you can't pay them, gift cards or letters of support, recommendations, community service, all that's really important. And then if you don't have an existing coalition, I think for sustainability, we were lucky and we did have a tobacco-free coalition. We did have an existing youth coalition, but you know, it's a very good way to keep the work going after the funding goes away, if you have staff to support a coalition, of course. And that's it. So, thank you.
About 9, almost 10 years ago, and some of you have heard me say this before, the single most important moment in the start and the global movement that followed smoke-free beaches was a partnership we established with the Surf Rider Foundation. That was the defining moment. And I'm sickened to see today that if you go on Philip Morris's personal responsibility website, one of the strategies they talk about in promoting their agenda is to partner with your local surf rider foundation. Mm. They've done it with surf chapters, they did it in San Diego, they still, you know, and they're funding it, they're putting money into it, right? And they fund, and Keep America Beautiful is also have Keep California Beautiful, and they have Keep Oakland Beautiful, and they fund all of these city local efforts promoting their agenda. And it's disheartening to see kids doing a cleanup. It's youth engagement for the tobacco companies. And I think that we're not doing a good job of that, especially in the face of Philip Morris, that seemingly is coming out and saying, you know, we're going to help you do a better job of personal responsibility. So I think we need to consider some, you know, opening up our you know, kind of scope in terms of bringing in as even funded partners and mini grants at times. So that's just one thing that, and they also fund World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy. Mm-hmm. They fund the organization that coordinates the International Beach Cleanup, the mm-hmm. Ocean Conservancy, the ones that we get a lot of our data from. So that, you know, can kind of raise some suspicion. So we need to look at that and do a better job. I do have a question about receptacles and urns, and you know, I know in public health it pains us mm-hmm. to say pay for or to suggest it, but some of the most progressive policies have had a need and succeeded in part because they did recognize that people still smoke mm-hmm. and to direct them, and I know Dr. Novotny and I had this conversation about outdoor dining. When you have a perimeter of 20 feet, it can send people in any different direction. So how do you feel about it? Have ashtrays played a role, or how have you dealt with that issue?
You know, for
can
us.
Can I ask the speakers to
Recap and okay. I think everyone heard the question, right? So for us, I know. I'm sorry? Oh, okay. So there was a question about how do we feel about the use of receptacles and ashtrays, given some of the controversy around, you know, creating the perimeter around smoke-free areas. And I would say in California and at the state level, the way that we look at those items is really a transitional intervention. We don't look at that as the end-all, be-all solution to denormalizing smoking. But we do recognize that some of these new partners, such as these environmental groups or those that are concerned about smoke-free parks or beaches, oftentimes do stop at that. So part of the partnership, in our opinion, is to say, you know, we recognize it's something that is needed to transition people beyond, but we want to be able to help see that these policies are about getting people to quit smoking eventually. So the video, which I didn't show, and I really encourage all of you guys to take a look at it too, there at the very end, the little girl says, you know, if people really understood the impact of tobacco waste in the environment, maybe they wouldn't start smoking in the first place, and that's our goal. So the other thing that's come up with us with these receptacles is that why not use them as a cue to quit smoking? Instead of just saying, you know, don't smoke, you know, put your cigarette out here, put cessation messages on there, put messages as to why smoking is bad. So turn it from a cue to smoke to a cue to quit. So that's the part of the education that we're working on.
So I just wanted to say real quick, I don't want to speak in there because it's not an answer to the question, but about the...
Sure. You can go like this. if I did this.
Okay, thank you.
We'll pass.
Yeah, just let me.
Come over there and say it real quick.
So I just wanted to say that it's just too bad that with the MSA we didn't require the tobacco companies to put a colon after everyone they fund has to have a colon say funded by tobacco company. So maybe we could next MSA put that in your head so everyone knows. Actually, Stan has his hand up here. He probably can speak to it a lot better than me. But I have heard there is some research out there. It's to me, I think it's a growing body of evidence, and there needs to be more research into that behavior around that. And some of the preliminary focus group testing of the messages does suggest that because they don't know that this is the impact that they have, that raising that awareness actually is important. Some of our partners, like the Coastal Commission, California Coast Commission, they have done similar types of like survey work where they found the same thing, but they also recognize that education that we think needs to be raised can't just stop there, that you got to pair that with a policy too. And I think that's where the public health folks can really make a big difference. Okay.
This is for you too. Is there an infectious disease concern about the tobacco waste, you know, the filters, the butts?
You know, I'm going to pass it to the other researchers in the room here who may have that. I haven't seen that evidence. I mean, the research that it is. And you know, and I really would encourage, you know, growing that body of evidence. I mean, the research that I showed just a snapshot of in the presentation is the first that we've seen in all the years that we've done tobacco control that really helped to jumpstart. Like, there is a growing body of evidence to justify the work now, but there needs to be more. So even though we've determined that it is toxic to those fish, we still need to figure out what is that element that is, because everyone I've talked to at EPA or other folks that may have a role in putting policy in place, that's the question they're asking me. Well, what is it exactly? But you know, we want to act on just the little bit that we have so far, which is why the campaign is where it's at.
Well, just as somebody, I live in San Francisco, and the butt mitigation fee is just a tax. I mean, I would be shocked if most smokers knew that they were paying that. So it just reduces just the price of it. But I just wanted to talk about the horns, because we after much fighting, made UCSF tobacco-free. And that was also a big problem with people in the neighborhood started complaining. And the way the campus has been dealing with it, I mean, it actually was the biggest problem they had with the neighbors complaining. And the way the campus has been dealing with it lately, which seems to be working, is to just have outreach to the staff saying, you know, we'd be kind to the neighbors, you know, that this is, that we, the campus historically has put a lot of emphasis on getting along with the neighborhoods so they wouldn't get sued over various other things. And that was after many years of getting sued regularly. And that I was talking to the person who's in charge of implementation, and she said it seems to really be helping. And like one of the things they finally just put up some really aggressive signage around the campus about 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And they also, as part of that, have a sign showing the neighborhood and sort of highlighting that this is where people live. And that the number of complaints they said they were getting from the neighbors has really dropped. But it was a huge problem because here in San Francisco, especially out in the part of town where you see is the houses are generally built with the garage on the first floor and the house above, so, and there's usually a little overhang, so people were standing under the overhang smoking and going right into pieces of living room.
Wow.
So this led to, you know, a lot of unhappiness. And they're also, you know, counseling supervisors to, when they find staff doing that, to tell them to stop, even though they're off university property, they do have an obligation. Mm-hmm. they think that's, it's only been a month or two, but they do think that's helpful.
Do we take two more questions?
Just to continue the discussion, it's so exciting to be sort of upstream on this issue, you know, but with the upstream solutions. Thinking about, for example, the opportunities to perhaps work with the local compost or waste recycling programs, and I'm thinking locally here. So batteries, for example, are toxic, and therefore they don't go into the green compost bin, they don't go into the blue recycle bin, they don't go into the waste bin because of the toxicity. So what might be the potential, for example, to have a toxic collection site used with the information, for example, in our parks, for example. So Dolores Park, my neighborhood here in San Francisco, you know, has a site where a little informational stand, too, that would be the proper place to change the social norm,
yeah.
Not flicked, not put into the black bin because of the toxicity that's spread throughout the whole recology system,
mm-hmm.
the company that does it.
It boils down to a definition. So I've had the same conversation with our EPA folks at the state unofficially. And you know, even though the protocol used to in the study that I highlighted is the same protocol that the EPA uses, they have fallen short of actually calling it toxic waste or hazardous waste, because that in itself is a different term than tobacco waste. If it becomes hazardous, then it brings up all these different regulations on how they handle it, and then if people don't comply by it, then it goes with fines and follow-up. And right, and you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, we may be justified in the facts and you know, that it's the right thing to do, but it's also still very political too. And so to make that political jump, that's where the collaboration and like the community grassroots effort to really define it as such is really extremely important, to float up all the way up to like the state to say, look, there's a growing body of evidence, so the research needs to come along. There's also a growing momentum of the community that demands that. So it's really about definition. It's the definition and the political will to actually say, okay, we're going to call it toxic waste. We're willing and able to actually handle it in that way. And it boils down to money, and it boils down to politics.
Can I just add something real quick?
Yeah.
So the path I was going down was thinking of it as biohazardous waste.
Yeah.
That's another way. And that is, you know, having red boxes in the park.
Yeah. No, and the conversation, when we had our summit back in March, that conversation came up quite a bit. You know, like, if it truly is this detrimental to the environment, why isn't it? And it boils down to regulations and environment. So where the state is right now is we're really working hard to develop partnerships with our water folks, water resources, because they're bound by regulations by the federal government that come down to the state level. But they're not just concerned about cigarette butts in the water. They're concerned about all these other contaminants, too. So again, it's building that relationship and really demonstrating the public health impact from just this one cigarette product, too.
So, one more comment, and then we're going to wrap. People really do have to travel.
Tom Novotny from San Diego State. And one question about the biohazard. We actually, when we did the fish killing study, we actually used a machine-smoked cigarette. And one of the IRB questions, when we did the institutional review, they asked us, well, you're picking up the butts off the street, isn't that going to pose an infectious disease hazard to your test kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to kill them anyway, you know? it's an important question. The other thing, too, is that what we're really trying to do now, besides the analyses that will support the designation of the butt waste as hazardous waste, we're going to look at the chemistry, we're going to look at human potential human actual impacts of the chemicals that are found. We're looking at this principle of extended producer responsibility, which means that it's not the community's ultimate responsibility to take care of this stuff, it's the seller. Just as many producers have responsibility for electronic waste or, you know, the paint, the lead-based paint. So, I mean, we want to really shift the discussion and the policy attention towards extended producer responsibility and product stewardship as well, for like bars and restaurants or sellers who profit or facilitate smoking. Mm-hmm. Should they have a responsibility in cleaning up? Should the UCSF have a responsibility to clean up its neighborhood?
Can I just a real quick comment?
A
friend of mine is a musician named David Wilcox. Has a line in one of his songs saying, "Switch to non-filtered; it'll put you out of your misery quicker."
We got that idea too.
Well, you know, I have to.
So one we're going to say.
No, they're now. Wait, this is very important.
Dan.
So one of the presentations this morning. warning, the e-cigarettes are now pushing disposable e-cigarettes,
yeah,
which have batteries in them.
Yeah.
And so that, you could probably suck into the existing rules.
Let's thank our speakers.